This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We're going to be starting with three bills on nursing home COLAs, and what I would intend to do, hope to do, is first of all, Senate Counsel and Research Dave Giel is going to be making a brief overview of the comparison between them. Then we'll have brief presentations on each of the three bills, and some of the groups that are supporting them are working with each other already to try and do it. And obviously, the numbers that plug into them will be a budget division issue. So my intent would be, if there's support from the committee, would be to pass all three bills out to the budget division where those decisions will be made. But before we get to any of the bills, I just wanted to ask committee members, because of timelines and so on, we will be likely having some additional meetings. And I guess I'd like to get a sense if committee members have a strong preference for whether we meet on Fridays or whether we meet evenings. And if so, is 6 o'clock a good time for evening meetings? If anybody has strong comments, I welcome them now. If not, if you tell our office in the next day or two, we'll factor that in. Let us know in the next day or two if you have a strong preference for when we have the additional meetings. With that, Mr. Giel, could you do a brief overview of the comparison of the different COLA bills?
Mr. Chairman, members, be happy to. You should all have a copy of my overview. It's on the long paper, the landscape format. Says comparison of Senate files 281, 679, and 843. The one thing that these three bills all have in common is that they have an across-the-board COLA for nursing facilities. Senate file 281 has 7% the first year and 6% the second year. Senate file 679 has 5% each year, and Senate file 843 has a blank percent each year. Section 6 of Senate File 281 also has 2% each year for a quality add-on. And Section 3 of 679 has 1% the first year for the costs of direct care employees hired on or after 10-107. Both 281 and 679 have a provision in Section 4 that requires the implementation of new case mix indices on 10-107. Section 5 of 281 requires nursing facility rates to be rebased on 10-108 to recognize increased nursing facility expenses. And 679 in Section 7 has a study of the rebasing issue. Section 1 of 281 expands the service contracts under which nursing facilities may receive up to 300% of their highest rate for serving high needs residents. Currently, only ventilator-dependent residents may be reimbursed using that method. Turning to the second page, next issue is COLA rate increases for intermediate care facilities for persons with mental retardation. And both 679 and 843 have a blank percentage increase each year for these facilities. Same with the COLA for the community-based providers. 679 and 843 both have a blank percentage increase. Senate File 679 lists 21 provider types that would qualify for the increase. And 843 lists two additional provider types and also includes consumer-directed community supports. On the bottom of page 2, the additional provider requirements to qualify for the COLA. There are none in Senate File 281. In 679, 75% of the COLAs are set aside for employee wages and benefits. Nursing facilities and ICFMR must apply to DHS and get a plan approved for the employee portion of the COLA and must make a copy of the plan available to employees, and a complaint process is established for employees who don't receive the benefits in the plan. And on the top of the next page, in 679, the community-based providers simply have to make a copy of their distribution plan available to employees. 843, on the bottom of page 2, all the providers, the nursing homes, the ICFs, and the community-based providers just have to make a copy of their plan available to employees, and there's a complaint process established. On page 3, there are a couple of miscellaneous provisions. In Senate File 679, Section 1 authorizes tuition subsidies for health care education and additional workforce incentives. And Section 6 suspends for 1 year the barrier to Minnesota care for persons with access to employer-sponsored insurance if the employer is a nursing facility. And Senate File 843, Section 3 has an additional rate increase for covered providers that employ overnight sleep staff. And the increase would apply when the federal minimum wage exceeds the state minimum and pay the difference between the two. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Guillo at this time? And he can obviously answer questions as we move along with them. I think what we'll do. We will try and turn the mics up. I will begin by presenting Senate File 679. We'll present each of the three bills and then can discuss them. And if the committee wishes, again, my intent would be that because the actual decision on the amounts is going to be determined as part of the budget decisions, that we would pass all three versions out, and some of the details would obviously be worked out. Some of the groups that are involved behind each of these bills are already talking with each other, have been for a while. But if we could pass them out, because the final decisions are going to be made by Senator Berglund's budget division. And with that, I'll present. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon.
Senate File 679 is, as all these bills are, adjusting the COLA for nursing facilities. And this bill, this was put together by a coalition of seniors and workers, and would intend that much of the COLA is being used to increase the wages and benefits for employees. I think one of the frustrations that affects the quality of care in our nursing homes is the heavy turnover of employees and the fact that they are so poorly paid. I think that affects the quality of care, and it's also a matter of fairness to the employees who are providing health care to others and who are struggling themselves to pay their own bills. So I think the fact that this was a coalition of seniors and of workers putting it together says a lot for it. In addition to the 5% annual increase, we also provide extra 1% for additional employees, because the hope is that the staffing ratios are bare minimal things, and I think the quality of care goes up if we have more employees. So this would provide a 1% increase for any new employees hired after October of this year. And I believe some of the additional provisions, such as the tuition subsidies for healthcare education, make good sense to help. Again, the big push of this is make sure we treat the employees fairly and provide more employees to help improve the quality of care. I'd be happy to stand for questions, but otherwise I think we just like to turn it over to two witnesses to make their comments on the legislation.
Good afternoon and welcome.
Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jane Okramovich. I am pleased to represent the Alzheimer's Association in support of the Seniors and Workers for Quality 2007 legislative initiative, Senate File 679, that's authored by Senator Marty. Our coalition, and you have a copy of those who are in our coalition, is built on the connection between quality care and quality long-term care jobs. Our bill reflects many facets of that relationship. Today, the common theme in the bills before you is a cost of living adjustment, or COLA, for long-term care workers. However, our bill covers all bases: residential facilities, home and community care. The 5% COLA that we propose for all facilities will make a difference, particularly with the provisions of the bill that dedicates 75% of the funds to the salary and benefits of employees. As you will note, there are several sections of the bill that focus specifically on nursing homes. For example, additional funding is provided for hiring new hands-on staff. Financial pressures and layoffs over the last 4 years have made working short dangerously prevalent. Short staffing yields hurried care, risk to residents, back injuries for staff, and low morale all around. Those back injuries represent just some of the reasons that health insurance for these low-wage workers is financially out of reach. Our bill would open Minnesota care to them, even in circumstances where the employer offers coverage, because that coverage is usually too costly for them to buy. We also realize that the health care access issue is broadly before you this year. Please make sure that healthcare workers can obtain health care insurance for themselves. We advocate for this mission. The method is totally up to you. Some of the most challenging nursing home care is needed by those with Alzheimer's and related disorders. Senate File 679 recognizes that behavioral care has not been adequately reimbursed in our acuity-based reimbursement system. A few years ago, the Department of Human Services commissioned research that verified what seniors and workers have known from experience. So let's not wait any longer to provide the resources for staffing of behavioral care. Now to a larger point. Nursing home rates differ not only by resident needs, but by historical distinctions among regions of the state and individual adjustments for specific facilities and counties. We support taking a fresh look at principles of fairness through a rebasing of the rates. I complete this testimony with a look to the future, to my own long-term care and yours. We hear a lot about the downsizing of the nursing home sector and the specialized care that will be their niche. We hear a lot about the flourishing of home and community-based care. We have few hard facts about where this workforce for tomorrow's care is coming from. Our bill asks that we commit funds to providing educational opportunities to prepare people for a variety of direct care careers. The healthcare core curriculum was developed as a result of legislation carried by Senator Berglund back in 1999. We don't have to start from scratch, but we do have to be realistic when we talk about where people will be cared for in the future and assure the availability of trained caregivers. I would thank you very much for your support and your attention.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness from the committee? Senator Marty, could you introduce? Mr. Hunt, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Stephen Hunt. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity that I have to speak today in support of Senate File 679. I have more than 20 years' experience as a direct caregiver, and most of that has been in long-term care as a nursing assistant and trained medication aide. I'm now working in the long-term care sector for SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, Local 113. First, I would like to review what has happened since the last COLA increase. Even with the union sign-off and targeted money to wages, many nursing home workers saw less of a wage increase than they would have expected. In the case of the Maplewood Good Samaritan nurses, their compensation dollars were bottomed out by the employer's ability to deduct increased costs of health insurance, workers' compensation, and payroll taxes. Their 75% of the last COLA amounted to $45,487 to be distributed among all members of the group. After deductions were made, health insurance, workman's compensation, and payroll taxes, the current offer for wages and benefits is zero for the entire facility. In the case of Green Acres Nursing Home in North Branch, the facility received nothing for quality add-ons and carries the additional burden of increased health insurance. In the case of the St. Lucas Care Center in Faribault, if all of the employer's look-back dollars are deducted, there will be no money left for wages and benefits. These are just a few examples of why it is so important to make sure that the COLA that you consider has every opportunity to successfully meet the challenges we face. The union sign-off is absolutely essential to deliver any COLA increase to the workers and increase wages. All new money needs to adequately address the issue of wages that are needed to attract and keep new people in the long-term care industry. Senate File 679 addresses the impact of wages, training, staffing levels, and reductions of hours and increases in mandatory overtime and health care for health care workers in a fiscally responsible way that also anticipates changes and needs in long-term care in Minnesota. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I think you all should have handed out a letter from AARP expressing their support for this. And I just wanted to make one or two additional comments. Again, the high turnover really does, because of low wages, really does affect quality of care. I remember talking with one woman in a nursing home who said how the loss of dignity when you have 6-8 people in 1 year who may be the people bathing you. That's something we don't always think about. But when you have heavy turnover, you've got that kind of a problem. And there is the simple injustice, I would suggest, when we have people who are providing the health care for others who cannot themselves afford health care for their families. And as Mr. Hunt pointed out, many of the people who were supposed to get the COLA increase last time did not get it. So I think it's very important that we target a large portion of it to make sure it goes into the increased benefits. But I'm happy to stand for any questions. I think this bill, again, the issues, all these issues, whether the funding for more staffing, the COLA itself, the additional issues we're putting in here and in the other bills are all going to be part of the budget discussion. But I think this is an important aspect of it, so I'd appreciate your support.
Are there any questions? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, thank you. I want to understand the intent of the bill. And I guess one of the questions I have is it's not always clear to me that if the objective is to improve the quality of care in a facility or the quality of any output, simply raising wages is not necessarily result in that. In other words, if you're trying to solve a business problem and you're having whatever the service might be and you want to improve that, it's not necessarily the case that simply paying your employees more is going to result in that better service. And so I think the point you're trying to make, as I understand it, is that we've had the inability to attract or retain or to maintain staffing levels at the appropriate point. And I'm wondering, does the bill address what those staffing levels ought to be? In other words, my question is, should the focus be on we need to have a staffing level of whatever, I'm not familiar enough with the details to know, but set that, and then say that's going to cost X to do that, and so let's appropriate the money to accomplish that goal, rather than say our goal here is to raise the wages without really understanding whether that's going to have any real impact on attracting more people to work in the industry or to deal with the quality issues. Can you comment on that and help me to see the...
This bill does not change any staffing ratios. However, as I pointed out, that 1% per year COLA increase to get more staffing will help increase staffing. I mean, that's the point of that. The issue in terms of quality of care and payment, if you have somebody who is making a comfortable living and you increase their compensation by 10-20%. I always think when you look at the CEO compensation issue, when they decide they're going to give somebody a big bump in pay, does that improve the quality of their work? I think some would argue so. I'm not sure it does. However, there are two issues here, one of which is when the pay is so low that people can't afford their basic needs, there's an issue of basic fairness, and I think it does impact the quality of care because people who are struggling so much, first of all, they may go to work when they're not totally healthy because they need the work, they need the hours. When they don't have the health care, they don't take good care of their own health. And frankly, the turnover, because people can't make a living doing this. I think one of the reasons I'm pleased to be working with these groups is the Seniors and Workers for Quality. We have senior groups who are there primarily because of their concern of the quality of nursing home care, working with some of the groups that are concerned particularly about the employees. I'd argue it's two things. One, it's fair treatment for the employees, and two, it does increase the quality of care. But no, it does not require any enhanced staffing. It does provide funding for some enhanced staffing, And I would make the case, and I believe it very strongly, that increasing the compensation for the employees is two things. One, a matter of fairness, and two, it will improve the quality of care.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from Senator Burden?
Madam Chair, I have just two comments. The first one is in regard to the testimony from SEIU. And I have heard from other caregivers in our system who do not work for nursing homes or any other institutional-based provider that all of their COLA increase last biennium was given to health care benefits, and not everyone, in fact, not most of the providers in the organization are able to take advantage of the health care benefits. And so I know none of these bills really address that issue, but I think we need to do some. I mean, I think most of us believe when we pass a COLA, we go out and talk to the public and we talk to the care providers that somehow everybody's going to get something, some kind of a wage increase out of it. At least I do. And we haven't had this problem in the past, even though the language allowing for consideration of benefits as a part of the compensation package has been there. And I'm not sure why it's coming now. I mean, I realize the COLA that we were able to give last time was pretty small, but still, there have been other years when we've had kind of small COLAs. So I just think it's something that we need to think about and try and do something about this year so that we make sure that doesn't happen again. It could happen regardless, I think, of the amount of COLA that you give and regardless of the safeguards in the legislation about filing a plan and making the plan available to the workers, et cetera. So that's one issue. The second issue is in regard to health care benefits for long-term care workers. This is an issue that I started working on before 2003. And then, we got hit by a train wreck. And some of us, especially me, have been kind of bogged down in the weeds ever since trying to find our way back up to the oxygen level. But I think it's time to look at this issue again. And I just wanted to say for the record, the idea that I had was to earmark a part of the rate, to give a rate for providing the health care, to earmark that rate for the health care so that, Senator Marty, we could take advantage of the fact that a large percentage of our long-term care is financed through federal dollars. And if we just have people come into Minnesota Care, we have certainly a large number of them. If they don't have if they're not families with children, then they get no federal funding for their health care through that door. So it's more complicated because some, as I said earlier, some are getting health care in their rate. And so it's a matter of trying to sort all that out so that we're not giving a rate increase for the same thing twice. But I think it is something that we should be working on over the interim.
Thank you. Senator Marty, do you care to respond?
I thank the committee, and we will, before we vote on any of the three, we'll take the next bills up. So maybe we start with Senator Brettner Solins and then Senator Berglund's.
Okay, so we don't take a motion now?
No reason to now. We'll hear them all, but again, my intention would be to pass them all to the Budget Division, which is where these decisions will have to be made. So.
Thank you. Thank you to the witnesses for your testimony.
File 281.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I'm pleased to present Senate File 281, which is a financial stability package for nursing facilities across the state of Minnesota. This proposal is supported by the Long-Term Care Imperative, a collaboration of care providers of Minnesota and the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. This bill is a bipartisan effort to take the first steps toward addressing the significant needs our state will face in caring for our older Minnesotans. Minnesota is getting older. By the year 2011, baby boomers will begin to retire, and by 2030, our senior population will have tripled. But while the age wave seems far off in the distant future, we must prepare for it now. The simple reality is that we are in no way prepared for the age wave, and before we can talk about preparing for the future, we must ensure that our existing care centers are stable. Over the past 4 years, we have asked care centers to participate in the solution to the state budget deficit by either freezing reimbursement rates or providing an increase that was less than the rate of inflation. In the past 4 years, rate increases for care centers have totaled just 4.6%, while inflation over that period was 11.6%. This funding situation has hit care centers hard. Unlike other sectors of the budget, care centers have no way to make up for funding cuts through increased fees or taxes. Rather, they have to make choices that directly impact the residents they serve. Maintenance to buildings have been deferred, facilities have had to spend down reserve funds just to keep their doors open, and benefits to employees have been cut. The Long-Term Care Imperative has estimated that more than 130 nursing facilities are at risk for closure in the state due to dire financial conditions. And I can speak just for the Arrowhead region of Minnesota, where 43% of the nursing homes in that area are in jeopardy of closing their doors. Yet research indicates we cannot afford to lose any more beds in nursing facilities at this time, and that's particularly true in greater Minnesota in the rural areas, where, first of all, it affects the economy in that area, but also if we close those facilities in greater Minnesota, then families are going to be far removed from their loved ones who may have to move to large urban areas in order to be cared for. We have an obligation as a state to adequately reimburse facilities for the quality care they provide to our parents and grandparents. Years ago, we passed a statewide policy called rate equalization that requires care centers to charge the same rate to private pay residents as it does to those who use medical assistance. As a result, the rate we decide we will pay facilities is the rate they must charge across the board. And I'm not suggesting that we undertake a debate on the policy of rate equalization today, but recognize that because of that existing policy, we have also established an obligation by the state to adequately pay for the services our parents and grandparents receive. Senate File 281 asks the legislature to rectify our past budget decisions by providing a rate increase of 7% in the first year of the biennium and an additional 6% for the second year of the biennium. The 7 and 6% rate increases are based on real need and are a sort of catch-up that takes into account actual inflation and actual rate shortfalls of the past 4 years. This will help stabilize the financial picture for care centers so that we can begin to move out of addressing the need for older adult services in a crisis mode and begin to discuss what we will need to meet the age wave of the future. I also recognize that there are rate disparities among nursing facilities throughout the state of Minnesota. Some of the local bills before you today are symptomatic of that problem. The disparities have been perpetuated by inadequate state funding and by a failure to rebase reimbursement rates in more than a decade. Senate File 281 proposes that we address this issue on a statewide basis by rebasing rates in 2008. Senate File 281 is more than about funding. This is about ensuring our elderly, our parents, and our grandparents have a quality health care system that will take care of them in all stages of their lives. Hubert Humphrey once said that the moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. We are fortunate to have passionate, mission-driven caregivers throughout the state who want to care for our seniors. However, we must ensure that we provide those caregivers with the resources to ensure they provide the very best care. If we do not, we have failed to meet our moral obligation as a government. And I'm not going to walk you through the bill, since Mr. Gill was kind enough to point out the differences between the three major bills. However, I would like to really make a plea for rebasing, because actually the few increases that we have had in recent years have been based on major disparities in the cost that those facilities have in the first place. So there is great inequity throughout our state about the reimbursement rates of some of those facilities. And again, in my own district, I'm aware of at least three facilities that are far below the average, and one of them that is actually paid more than $17 less per day than the next highest paid, or lowest paid, rather, nursing facility. So there is something that we need to do about these disparities. Now, I have with me today John Korzendorfer, who is from Ecumen, Director of Operations and Campuses in Duluth, Randy Hegemeyer, Birchwood Care Home in Minneapolis, and Linda Dewar, St. Benedict's Senior Community in St. Cloud. So, Mr. Korzendorfer.
Thank you, Senator Solon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Korzendorfer. I am the Director of Campus Operations for Ecumen. Ecumen operates about 20 nursing homes, 55 housing projects, and a variety of senior opportunities throughout the state of Minnesota and over 100 communities across Minnesota. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate File 281. The state has a moral obligation to provide quality care for our seniors. These are our parents and our grandparents. They helped make this state. They're the taxpayers who built the top-notch healthcare systems, the interstate highways, quality university systems, and they deserve quality care in their senior years. And the state has to invest to have quality care. Ensuring quality care for our seniors is a statewide issue. I see it throughout my travels across Minnesota. One of the facilities I work with is Bayshore Health Center in Duluth. Bayshore is a 200-bed nursing facility. It's about a $12 million a year operation. 70% of its costs or revenue stream is expended on service components, which are staff salaries and benefits, over $8 million a year. We service about 380 clients annually at that facility. It's a very, very important member of the community. The existing reimbursement system has caused serious inequities, as Senator Solon just discussed. These inequities have caused us to make decisions that directly impact quality of care. Facilities across the state are making similar decisions. Some examples I want to share with you. In Litchfield, Minnesota, we now have to transport 85 miles our nursing home residents to get dental services. In Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, we recently lost a nurse to its neighboring hospital four blocks away, and she got paid $8 an hour more to go. Staffing is the biggest concern I have across the state of Minnesota for our long-term care facilities and all of our senior care providers. Historically, there was about a 20% pay equity difference between acute care and long-term care. Today, it's as high as 58% pay equity. By not investing in long-term care, we have cut the only place that we literally can cut, which is in our staff, and it's unfair, it's unjust. Senate File 281 provides a statewide solution to a statewide problem. For years, the state has failed to fulfill its moral obligation to fund quality care in nursing facilities. The rate increase proposed in this bill is a minimum amount needed to meet today's obligations. The 7% and 6% is a firm ask. It's not based on politics, and it's really not based on negotiations. Senate File 281 is a step toward ensuring that seniors will have access to quality long-term care. Minnesotans are thoughtful people who plan ahead. We play what if because that's our job. Today across Minnesota, the disaster team is preparing for a potential planned bird flu epidemic. The avian flu, we all hear about it. In nursing home operations, I play what is. 40 nursing homes have closed across Minnesota over the last 5 years. Duluth alone has delicensed 370 nursing home beds. We must fund Senate File 281, or you'll have a senior pandemic on your hands next. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Korzendorfer.
Next. Good afternoon, Chairman Marty and members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today. My name is Linda Doran. I'm Vice President of Senior Services for St. Benedict's Senior Community in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to talk about Senate File 281, and I'm specifically speaking about Section 1. That allows the Commissioner of Human Services to negotiate a higher nursing facility rate for ventilator-dependent care, and we're asking that that be extended to other categories of residents requiring specialized services. This section was included for several reasons: to respond to the admission requests nursing facilities are receiving from various hospitals, and to recognize that many of the nursing facility residents of today are those short-stay post-acute residents who require complex medical care, rehabilitation, or time to heal and recover from an acute care episode. You've probably heard, or you will hear today, that 82% of residents admitted to nursing homes are staying less than a year. Half of them are staying less than 35 days. Most are coming from a hospital. They're very complex. Our current payment structure does not provide us with the flexibility we need to provide short-term care for some of these residents. Current law allows for a negotiated rate for certain ventilator-dependent residents only, up to a cap and at the discretion of the commissioner. We're just asking for an expansion of the same mechanism for a few specific categories requesting our services. And just to give you a few examples, one of those is bariatric care, which you probably know is for medically defined obesity. And facilities who admit a bariatric resident likely are in need of many pieces of equipment to be able to handle these residents. They'll need specially designed commodes, shower chairs, specialized beds. They may need to have specialized electric lifts so that they preserve the workforce and prevent back injuries. They may need to redesign the room and include the lifts into the ceiling of the room so that it properly handles the residents. They need to make sure the doorways are wide enough for the equipment. The shower room is wide enough to shower the resident. They'll need to have enough staff available to take care of this kind of a resident, to be able to transfer them and move them when they're needed. A typical nursing facility has about 3.5 to 4 direct nursing hours per day. Twice that occurs in the hospital, and they're coming directly from that hospital. And oftentimes, these residents are a little bit younger. They require often an increased need for social and psychological services when they're in our facilities. All of that costs money. Another example is tracheotomy care. One of our member facilities, Bethel Care Center, who currently contracts for ventilator care, completed a study last year comparing the cost of ventilator-dependent residents against the cost of a few of the skilled care tracheotomy patients that they accept as residents. Tracheotomy is not covered. They determined that on average they spent 19 hours and 32 minutes of all direct care staff per day on tracheotomy residents, and comparing that to 21 hours of direct care per day on the ventilator-dependent residents. Yet there was no ability to receive any extra reimbursement for the tracheotomy resident. In addition to the comparable staff time and expense, tracheotomy residents typically use more supplies than those that require ventilator care. This facility lost over $200 per day for each tracheotomy resident in staff time and supplies expense. So they're quite understandably hesitant to admit residents with those needs in spite of the numerous inquiries from the hospital. So we believe expanding the contracted rate section will save the healthcare system significant resources, will expand choices for the residents with these conditions, and will allow residents to be cared for closer to home. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Doerr. Mr. Hegemeyer?
Good afternoon, Chairman Martin and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Randy Hagemeyer. I'm the owner and administrator of Birchwood Care Home in Minneapolis. My nursing facility specializes in providing services to residents with cognitive impairments and behavioral considerations. And I want to specifically address the change that's needed in the weighting of the case mix rates. My staff has been waiting for 5 years for the recognition of the time they spend caring for our residents. The case mix indices should reflect the relative amount of care received by residents in different RUGS classifications. The staff time study released in 2004 provided what my staff realizes every day. The weights for residents with cognitive impairments are underweighted. The new weights would more accurately reflect the staff time and cost for care of residents in my facility. When caring for individuals with cognitive and behavioral concerns, the issues must be addressed immediately. This does not and cannot be addressed only by nursing staff. Behaviors can and do occur all over our facility. Therefore, it's vital for the care of our residents that all staff from all departments are trained in how to intervene and redirect a resident. The quicker a behavior is addressed, the less likely it will escalate. While we may be able to measure the time a particular nursing procedure will take, behavior intervention and redirection are not so readily measured. This, again, is why all my staff need to be involved and are involved with the care of our clients. It's detrimental to tell the client that a nurse will be with you shortly. I need to emphasize that implementing the new weights without adjusting the payments does nothing to recognize the additional staff resources spent addressing behavior issues. My facility is one of the lowest rate facilities in the state, even though it's located in the metro area, mainly because we have historically served individuals with more behavioral needs rather than intense clinical needs. I also have one of the lowest nursing staff ratios because of these low rates and lack of recognition for the staff resources my resident population requires. If funds are not available to correctly implement the new case mix weights with corresponding adjustments in rates, then unfortunately, it'd be best not to implement them at all. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Any questions for any of the three witnesses? Or any questions for the author of the bill? If not, we will take this up with the others in just a couple minutes.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Berglund, Senate File 843.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I do have an A1 amendment.
Things start at 11, so
I'd like to move adoption of the amendment.
Should we do
it? Oh,
have
my God, no, I
it's in the packets, okay. Is there any, does everybody have the A1?
Mr. Chairman and members, the amendment just makes it clear that the COLA is to be based on the operating rate, not the total rate.
We have the A1 amendment in the packets. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This bill has a blank percentage increase for long-term care providers for each year of the biennium. And then it addresses the another issue that most of the time we don't always think about, and that is that some of the wages of some of the providers where they are overnight sleep staff by increases in the minimum wage. And so this bill does discuss what to do if the minimum wage is increased more than the state minimum wage is currently during this biennium, and provides some funding to make sure that that facility can meet that minimum wage increase without having to take something away from the COLA that would be provided for all of the employees in the facility. The other issue that this bill deals with that hasn't really been discussed in the other bills is that we have a number of long-term care providers now that are really providing services through managed care contracts. And there is concern that those long-term care employees are not benefiting from the same type of COLA increases that our fee-for-service type of providers are receiving when we pass COLA bills. And that creates some inequities and disparities across the system. So this bill does talk making sure that there's equal treatment for those providers. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we can take the testimony on the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson, you look like you're ready to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're a provider organization that represents about 160 providers who provide services in ICFSMR and the various waivers, the MRRC waiver or DD waiver, TBI waiver, and CADI waiver. We, among our membership, we employ about 27,000 direct support professionals who are responsible for taking care of often our most vulnerable citizens and they're providing for their health and safety and to whatever measure we have the resources enhancing their full citizenship and quality of life. And with me today are two of those 27,000 remarkable people, Rita Maganich Hastings from Crystal, Minnesota, and Bruce Thompson from Cambridge. Before I turn it over to them, and I'll let them talk more than I want to voice our gratitude for, as Senator Berglund put it earlier, the few bubbles that of oxygen that that bubbled up, and we're grateful. There, you know, we times were tough for all of us, but we were able to get a few of those bubbles of oxygen and keep going, and we're very grateful to Senator Berglund and to the Senate for doing that. At the same time, as you know, the cost of living, and you heard from previous testifiers, has continued to climb. And I handed out, this is part of our legislative agenda that we circulated earlier this year. But I wanted to point out three things on here, if I could. And that is that people who start working in this field, our members, according to our survey numbers, make just $9.86 an hour. That's only 25 cents over the poverty level for a family of four. Also wanted to note that 76% of the dollars that go into COLA, and our members, and we police it pretty hard, does go to the compensation of direct support professionals. And we have been talking with Senator Berglund, and we want to work with you and the other groups to make sure that that people do get something. And at the same time, we're able to cover our costs with around health insurance, and I love the idea, want to work with it on getting FFP to try to do that. So, but I wanted to point your attention to the chart at the bottom of the page, and that shows we did take a 1% cut in 2003 while inflation was climbing, and then nothing over the next year, and then the two bubbles of oxygen, 2.26% in each of the last 2 years, and that helped us get along. But as you can see, the cost of living, and as you're going to hear from the testifiers here in a few minutes, it's made life very difficult to not only provide the necessary services to people with disabilities, but also to just keep their families going and keep them whole as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, unless there are questions, I'll just turn it over to to Rita first, and you can hear firsthand how desperately we do need an additional COLA this year.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Ms. Maganich Hastings, go ahead.
Yes. I've never done this before, so bear with me. First of all, I wish to thank the committee for inviting me to speak on the COLA. My name is Rita Maganich Hastings, and I work for Dakota Communities Incorporated. I'm also the chair of the Direct Support Professional Association of Minnesota. Since being asked to testify at this committee and knowing that I have a short period of time to talk to you, I've gone through a lot of scenarios to try and come up with the right words to help you make the decision to support the COLA. So let me tell you who I am. I started in this field in 1966, working in the state regional centers. Like many of the young people of today, I worked for the state until going off to college, where with my education, I would get a good paying job and be able to afford the things that we all want, a home, a car, the occasional vacation. Somewhere along the line, after working in a variety of commercial and nonprofits, I found myself answering an ad by Dakota Communities. I thought I can do this for a while until I find something I like better that will help me afford the above-mentioned things. What I did not count on was that I would find that my initial decision of what I wanted to do with my life at 16 was the right one. So I've now worked for DCI for over 25 years. Between my degree in developmental psychology and 34 years of experience and training, I'm very good at what I do. I see my job as building bridges between the people I serve and the community in which they want to become fully integrated members. That means interpreting for individuals who sometimes have no ability to state what they need or want. In order to do this job, I have to have a relationship with the people I serve and know them well enough to be able to understand them. Another aspect of my job is training and supervising direct support professionals or advocates, and in that role, I have trained dozens of individuals over 25 years. There is nothing more exciting in that role than to train someone who also sees the people we serve as individuals who are so much more than their disabilities and can see the potential of each person. There is nothing more frustrating to watch those people walk away because they cannot afford to stay in this field due to the high cost of medical insurance and the low wages. If your child came to you after 4 years of college, which cost conservatively $30,000, to tell you that they were very excited about finding the perfect job and that the starting wage was less than $10 an hour, you might not be as excited as they are. If they further informed you that in spite of years of education, they might not get a raise since their raises are not based on their abilities, you might talk to them about finding a less exciting but more financially secure future. And if, in addition, they let you know that as a single parent, which I am, that they plan to have a home, car, the occasional vacation, and raise their child or children on less than $10 an hour, you might start wondering how many years you were going to support this child and your grandchildren. Yet this is the reality of DSPs, and I really can't tell you how we manage to do this. I do know that as my generation is looking to retirement, that finding those bright, dedicated individuals becomes harder and harder. I can train them, but I can't make them stay. I realize that many people come before this committee asking for money, and that's what I am here to do also. Without the COLA, we will continue to have a revolving door of bright, educated individuals pause in the lives of the people we serve, only to move on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Thompson?
I'm Bruce Thompson, and I'm from Cambridge, and I've worked with developmentally disabled young men for 10 years now. I really appreciate what you've done the last 2 years to give us a little bit of money to get along. I do this because it's a very necessary thing to do to help people that can't help themselves. I enjoy doing that, and I feel it's a real privilege and honor. It has an impact on family, especially these last probably 5 years. It's been financially hard to keep up with things. Healthcare, my company can't offer enough healthcare. I've had to go out and get my own, a catastrophic plan. Our mileage has been frozen for 5 years, and it was low to start with. Our wages have moved very little. We used to have a weekend differential of 50 cents per hour for people that worked on weekends, and that's been totally cut. Our mileage has been really cut as far as number of miles we can drive to support our consumers. In a month's time, I donate about 500 miles just to make sure that one of my clients has the care that he needs. I drive a 1995 van with 177,000 miles on it, and things are hard. I'm not here to whine or complain, but to say it's an important thing. You know, I could go be a carpenter and make three times the money I'm making doing this, but I see this as a real high privilege and a high honor to be able to help these people, and we need to attract and keep good workers, caring workers, and the impact of that has been great on me. My home is presently for sale to try to downsize my budget to keep up with things, and I just appreciate whatever you can do to help our part of the world and the developmentally disabled, and that they can have good lives and that they can be taken care of by people that really care about them. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to testify before the committee. Senator Berglund, do you have any other comments?
Yeah, I just have a few things that I'd like to say about this issue of COLA in general, and that is that last session the governor didn't have any COLA in his budget. And I think probably it was pretty much true on both sides of the aisle that people wanted COLA for the long-term care providers. In the Senate, we generated some revenue and went into conference committee with COLA. In the course of that conference committee, the revenue that was generated went away. There was still an expectation that there would be a COLA. Well, I don't print money in my office. I can just tell you that right now. And so we got the COLA, the couple of molecules of air that Mr. Nelson talked about, by cutting hospitals and cutting eligibility for the alternative care grant program. We are not going to do that this year. We already now have hospitals that are bleeding red ink because of the cuts that we made last biennium. And we already have cut the alternative care grant program, so it's only at 120% of poverty to be in the program. COLA is the top number on my request list for funding this session. I can tell you this. You can't give people what there isn't. There isn't money made available by us collectively for this area. You can't give it. Now, I do believe there should be some principles that we kind of go by, all of us, in the legislature. And I think one of them should be that we do not fund our own facilities that are run by our state employees. We do not provide a COLA to them that's higher than the COLA we provide to those who are doing the same work for the same type of people in the community. And so that is one of the things that I think we should at least, at a minimum, look at is, you know, whatever COLA we're giving for our 24/7 operations that are run by the state government, we should at least have the same COLA for our own long-term care providers that are in the communities that take care of our citizens back in our home districts. And remember, the base for the facilities that are operated by state employees is a higher base. So even if we get the same COLA, we're not giving everybody the same money. But, I mean, I think at a minimum, that is a fairness principle that we should try and operate by this year.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Are there any questions for Senator Berglund or any of the witnesses?
I just might add this also. Just because I think something is fair doesn't mean I always get it to come out the way I think it should.
Absolutely. No questions from the committee? Well, yes, Senator Brenasala. Are you going to
Madam Chair, I was just ready to move the bills.
Okay.
So I would start by recommending that...
I think the three bills need to be.
Yeah, which 679, is that the first one?
Yes.
That Senate file 679 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance.
And all of those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries. Now we need a second motion for the three. Senator Prentice.
And then that Senate File 281 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance.
Thank you. All of those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Motion carries. I'd like to move that Senate File 843 is amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you. All of those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Thank you. Now we're going to hear from Senator Vickerman, Senate File 286. Is he around? There he is. Okay. Welcome to the community, to the committee, Senator Vickerman.
Members of the committee. File 286, file that
I've been working on with my house partner. Wasn't able to get anybody from the nursing home industry to for my district to come up here, so I'm going to explain the bill the best I can by myself. And there is an amendment that Mr. Gill put, but I'd like somebody to offer that so I could get
Senator
it.
Senator Vickerman, could you please put the microphone close to you, closer to you? Thanks.
Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment for Senator Vickerman.
Thank you. Those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment carries. Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this I'm going to explain the bill, and then I'm going to take a little bit more about it. Senate File 286 is simply designed to provide rate adjustment for nursing homes that fall in the bottom tier of state MA reimbursement. The bill would provide a 6% rate increase for nursing homes whose MA reimbursement rate is 10% below the statewide average reimbursement rate. There are 395 nursing homes in Minnesota. The statewide average MA reimbursement rate for those homes is $118. If this bill passes, it would provide a 6% rate increase for about 156 nursing homes in 2008. The number of homes receiving an increase under the bill would go up to 198 homes in 2009. There are 17 nursing homes in my Senate district which receive an MA reimbursement rate that's below the statewide average. For example, Lakeview Nursing Home in Huron Lake currently receive a $99 MA reimbursement rate. Now, that rate is so low that the home is considering closing their doors. These aren't the only ones who can afford to operate under the existing MA reimbursement rate. And I understand, and I'm division chair myself, and I understand that this bill carries a significant cost to enact. But I would urge you to consider what will happen if we fail to make this investment in our rural nursing homes. We will lose a community-based service that's essential to maintaining a quality of life for senior citizens. I live 4 miles from Tracy. That's my hometown. They did have two nursing homes, one closed. And my closest neighbor, if I want to go and visit her, I have to drive 90 miles to Mankato to get to that home. Now, I know this is an expensive bill, but I would ask that you would at least keep it under consideration to see how we get along with the mix. I understand that. And you could say the same thing probably for quite a few other homes without the state that are struggling to try to make the money. So I agree to carry the bill. I want you to, I would hope that you would at least to consider it and see how it would fit into the mix.
Thank you, Senator Vickerman. Are there any questions for Senator Vickerman?
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
I just have one question, and that I think would probably be properly directed to Mr. Gill. Is the way the bill is structured to give an increase to every facility that's 6% below the average in their grouping, or just the ones that are 6% below the state median?
Mr. Gill?
Madam Chair, I believe it's structured to look at rates statewide.
Both approaches would be statewide.
Right, but this, I think, would put all the facilities in one group for purposes of coming up with this target value.
Okay, well, Madam Chair and Senator Vickerman, I just want you to know that there's more than one way to kind of address the concern that you have. And so I think we need to keep our minds open to other possibilities in the way you've structured this bill. Because, you know, what we hear from or what we get bills about, and I'm glad you're trying to do it more on a, you know, wholesale solution, but what we hear all the time is, nursing home A is 20 miles away from nursing home B, and they're serving the same people, the same type of people. And nursing home A is getting $20 a day more than nursing home B for serving that same patient. And that nursing home A, you know, is stealing the staff away from nursing home B because nursing home B can't pay as much as nursing home A does. And So it isn't just whether somebody's getting paid lower than everybody else in the state. It's also about whether you're getting paid lower than somebody across the street from you.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I bring this bill forward to hopefully this committee will take a look at what we can do. That's the reason I brought it forward. If we can't, we can't.
Sure.
But maybe there's something else we can do to help those nursing homes. You know, you have to remember when you live out where I am, if the wind blows, you don't go even 4 miles. There's no trains, no bus. There's no way to get from here to there. So it's important, I think, that we keep them as close as we can. And I know my neighbor. I visited her 2 months ago, and I'll be guilty. I bet I won't visit her till way after the session's over because it's 90 miles. It's 180 miles back and forth. And then you may go there that day, and she isn't quite up to par. And then you kind of wonder. I can't imagine what it would be like if it was your loved one. That'd be different.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Prentisall.
To keep this provision in the mix, I would move that Senate File 286 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
All of those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Remember, this bill is to help everybody.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Vickerman. Okay, we are now moving into Senate File 178. Senator Wergen.
Thank you. If I could get someone to take them, please.
We have somebody. Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair and members, I also have the A3 amendment to Senate File 178, if I could, please. Madam Chair, the A3 amendment simply adds Pine, Kennebec, and Meeker counties to the bill, which is already written to cover the differences in Wright, Mille Lacs, and Isani and Chisago counties when it comes to nursing home rate reimbursement. So I would offer the A3 author's amendment.
Okay. Members of the committee, do I have a quorum? Do I need a quorum? Seems like we lost members. I have a quorum? Sorry, Senator Wergen, I was just questioning if we have a quorum. We do. Okay, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
It's the amendment.
The amendment is adopted. Please
Thank
proceed,
you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Wergen.
Madam Chair, the underlying bill simply changes the rate reimbursement for nursing homes in these counties to the geographic group 3 median rate reimbursement. And I just dearly wish Senator Berglund was sitting in that chair right there because she just explained my bill. In her last summary, she said you have nursing home A 20 miles from nursing home B, and the one 20 miles away has substantially greater rate reimbursement. Well, guess what? The nursing homes I'm talking about have that situation on three sides of them. And these folks right here that are sitting with me have, probably three nursing homes within 20 miles that are getting a different rate reimbursement than they are. So it makes it very difficult. But what makes even more compelling argument is the sheet that you got that says Region 7E on the top. If you take a look at that, that is from the Jobs Now Coalition, and it's data from that book. What it says is that in Region 7E, the cost of living is only 1% lower than the metropolitan area. The cost of living is 1% lower than the cost of living in the metropolitan area. And yes, I repeated that for a reason, because the median income is 33% lower than the metropolitan area. And one of the problems is that our hospitals and our nursing homes, some of these facilities, are our largest employers, and they can't possibly compete because, yes, less than 20 miles down the road, folks are getting the Metro reimbursement and they're able to pay the wages according to that Metro reimbursement. And members, it's not just one source. And I have to thank Senator Tony Laurie. He supplied me with some fantastic information because we share this problem. Those same statistics are backed up in many ways by the state demographer's office in his halftime report. It talks about the growth in the region, the difference of rates, wages in the region. It talks about the aging population in the various regions. And all those statistics back up the need for this group of counties' rate reimbursement to change. I applaud Senator Vickerman's whole state approach, and I understand where he's coming from, but Senator Berglund is right. When the nearest nursing homes are less than 20 miles away, you have a really big problem keeping employees. And Senator Hand, I agree with you that money doesn't always make the difference, but boy, when we have to pay CNAs in this nursing home significantly less than the one 20 miles away, guess where they get their training? They get their training at this nursing home, and by hooky, they can get $1 an hour at the Hearst nursing home 20 miles down the road very quickly. And so it's very hard to hang on to employees. My mother-in-law was in a nursing home for 11 years, and yes, it's difficult to constantly be changing CNAs, RNs, LPNs. These are our senior citizens that deserve our respect and the best quality care that we can give them. And Madam Chair, I would like to introduce Mr. Bob Dahl from Elam Incorporated and Mr. Todd Lundeen, the administrator of the Princeton Elam Nursing Home. And I could have brought folks from every single nursing home in each of these counties, but out of respect for your time and not wanting to be redundant, these are the folks that are here. So thank you.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please
thank
introduce
you.
Yourself. And
my name is Todd Lundeen. I'm the administrator of Elam Care and Rehab Center in Princeton. We're a 125-bed skilled nursing facility that operates near capacity, and we serve a community and surrounding area of 22,000 people. Our campus also features assisted living and an adult daycare center. I've seen a lot of changes in my 25 years in the business. I know some of you might look at me and say, I can't believe he's been in the business for 25 years. I do have old hair. I'm here today, to go to bat for our residents and for our elders that we serve and for our staff. Our residents deserve more care, and many of our staff, the frontline caregivers, can't make a living on $8.50 to $10 an hour that we can pay them. Oh, believe me, the staff rarely complain, and neither do the residents. Each of our nursing assistants care for 8 to 10 residents, and their residents see how hard they work to provide their care. The residents need more help, but they feel sorry for their caregiver and the speed at which they must do their work. The staff don't toot their own horn. They didn't start in this business to make a quick buck. All they want to do is continue to provide the great care that our residents need, make a decent living above the poverty level, and to be respected by getting paid fairly for a job well done. But nursing homes can't do that. The system is broken. You've already heard that today from a number of people. Minnesota nursing homes have been paid for years based on a government-set increase over last year's rate. These daily rates are set by the Department of Human Services. Many years ago, the state paid us on last year's cost plus an inflationary factor. The federal government sets the amount of money that the state gets for the Medicare and the Medicaid program. And in those years, they guaranteed that a nursing home would get paid its last year's cost, at least its allowable costs. Those years are long gone. In the 19 years that I've been at Elam, we've done okay financially, except for the last 3 years, in which we've lost $922,000. We eked it out through the two-year state-mandated freeze in our rates by cutting staff, by increasing the co-pays and the deductibles on health insurance that our staff pay, and we've renegotiated many supply contracts. We've spent thousands of hours in this process of cutting costs, time taken away from caring for our elders. We've spent our depreciation dollars for staff pay increases. Last fall, when the state gave us 2% of an increase, with permission to give some to staff and set aside some for rising costs, we did what some would say is foolish. We gave staff the whole 2%. We had to hold up our end of the bargain to take care of them, for we needed them to help us take care of our frail elders. When our staff health insurance costs rose $89,000 in the last 3 years, we took the hit. When the utility bills rose $32,000 in the last 3 years, we took the hit. Minnesota's older adult services providers can't take any more hits. With funding decreases to the Medicaid and Medicare programs again being talked about in Washington, nursing home staff get nervous. and so do the elders who are relying on them to care for them. Will the next cut be the fatal one for another nursing home in Minnesota? If you're concerned about the degree of care that we exercise to operate our elders' home, you need to know that our home is well run. We enjoy the fact that all of our RN and LPN positions are filled, despite the fact that our reimbursement is much lower than facilities that are in our area. We have very few nursing assistant positions open. We use no nursing pool. Our occupancy runs 3 and 4% above the state average. Our Medicare occupancy is 3 and 4% above the state average as well. It's just that there are no more opportunities to cut costs. We laid off staff 2 years ago, our first layoff in over 20 years. We ask that you vote for legislation to improve the funding for nursing homes. Minnesota's 38,000 elders who need this level of care and their caregivers are depending on you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. Senator Pretner-Solon.
Mr. Chair. I would like to amend this bill, and I'd like you to hear me out. And I'd like to add my name as an author to your bill. I see you have a space left. I would like to, after counties on line nine, after counties add and the city of Duluth, and on line 10, after counties add and the city of Duluth. And the reason for this is that it's come to my attention that while St. Louis County is in the level three? Is that what it's called?
Group three.
Yeah. That there have been some increases that have increased the disparity between Duluth and the rest of St. Louis County. And so this would equalize those Duluth facilities that are within St. Louis County also.
Senator Pretner-Solon moves. Could you restate the...
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to add after counties on line 9 and the city of Duluth, and after counties on line 10 and the city of Duluth.
On that motion.
Mr. Chair. Flipping here. Senator Pretner-Solon, I'd be happy to add that amendment, and I'd be happy to have you as a co-author. We have a mutual problem that absolutely needs to be dealt with. Thank you,
Senator Wirken.
Thank you. Further discussion on the Solon amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make one concluding statement. All of the folks that you heard from prior to these two folks and this bill were from facilities that are already at a much higher reimbursement rate than they are. So can you imagine the problem that these folks face when the cost of living is only 1% lower than the metropolitan rate and the median wage is 33% lower than the metropolitan rate and the homes that they're competing with are literally within 20 miles. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion, if not, Senator Wirken moves that Senate File 178 as amended be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I believe you have in your packets, in addition to Senate File 377, an A1 amendment that also would need to be attached. It comes from the department, and it's a technical amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill simply deals with a rate adjustment and some timing issues that were off on their application for the transfer of some closure dollars on some beds. And, you know, Mr. Todd Howell from the facility that was to gain that benefit is here to talk to you a little bit about that issue.
Mr. Howell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today supporting Senate File 377. My name is Todd Howland. I'm the administrator at Graceville Health Center, located in Graceville, Minnesota. We have 50 Medicare and Medicaid certified skilled nursing facility beds, a 15-bed critical access hospital, and two rural health clinics. I'm here today to ask for the plan closure rate adjustment for an 8-bed facility previously located in the city of Clinton, Minnesota, that was to have reassignment to Grace Home in Graceville, Minnesota. Initially, the Clinton Providence Center was owned by Graceville Health Center. In 2004, Graceville Health Center decided to close the Clinton Providence Center. With opposition to the closing from the city of Clinton, Graceville Health Center agreed to sell the facility, including 8 skilled nursing facility beds, to the city of Clinton for their use as an 8-bed nursing home and assisted living facility. In the purchase agreement, the city of Clinton agreed that if they ever needed to close the remaining beds, they would follow the proper process to transfer the closure rate adjustment to Graceville Health Center. In 2005, the city of Clinton decided to close the remaining 8 beds and to become only an assisted living facility. As stated in the purchase agreement, city of Clinton staff filled out the appropriate paperwork for the plan closure rate adjustment and sent the appropriate page to Graceville Health Center to sign. The paperwork was signed in June 2005 and returned to Clinton for completion and submission prior to the final bed closure. After sending the paperwork back to the city of Clinton, Graceville Health Center staff understood that Clinton staff would file the paperwork pursuant to the contract. The skilled nursing facility beds were closed in Clinton on August 4, 2005. However, Clinton staff did not submit the paperwork to the Department of Human Services until after the bed closure on September 3, 2005. Because the Clinton facility did not file the paperwork in a timely fashion, the plan closure rate adjustment was denied. It is Graceville Health Center's position that we acted in good faith and did everything possible to make sure the rate increase was received. Senate filing 377 provides a legislative remedy for this situation and allows for Graceville Health Center to be in a position similar to that had the original paperwork been submitted to the Department of Human Services. Members, I ask for your support of this legislation and would be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Questions for Mr. Howell or Senator Kubley? Discussion on the bill.
I'll move the bill for Senator Kubley.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 377, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
And Senator Berglund, we've got one more of your bills, I believe. Senate File 261.
Chairman and members of the committee, we've been primarily talking about operating rates today, but this bill deals with property rates and what we do about property. And one of the things that the bill does is to provide some funding for the moratorium exception process. And it's an amazing thing to me. We've had the moratorium on nursing home beds for decades now, and I've never seen a governor put any money in his budget all of that time to fund the moratorium exception process, which is the only vehicle we really have in the state of Minnesota for allowing our nursing homes to reinvest in remodeling or rebuilding themselves. And you've heard a little bit about the aging structure of the facilities that we use for our nursing home system in Minnesota. So that's one of the things that this bill does. And it does a number of other things in terms of changing the criteria somewhat for the process of considering the competitive proposals that are submitted to the moratorium process, and ways for then also providing payment for improvements and mandates that are on our nursing homes for their upgrades that are not remodelings, but are upgrades that are required by codes. And so with me today is Patty Cullen to explained the further details of the bill.
Ms. Cohen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Patty Cullen. I'm Vice President at Care Providers in Minnesota. I think Senator Berglund did a good job in overview, and given the late time, I'm just going to highlight just a couple of other things that are included in the bill. In Section 1, the one criteria that's currently added, in the moratorium exception process, it's a competitive process, and there's an internal group that looks at all of the proposals that have come forth, and they apply the criteria and assign points. And one of the things we thought would be important to add as a criteria is the consideration for future demand for those beds in that area. If you're going to build a new facility, let's make sure that it's built in an area of the state where you're going to need beds in the future. And many of you we've met with earlier this session and talked about the research that we've done looking at where beds will be needed in parts of the state. So that information will be available, so we thought it would be important to add that as a criteria that our members need to take a look at when they come forth before this committee. The technical changes in Sections 2 and 3 address some concerns we've had given back to us from our members who've gone through the process. They are the numbers that are in the process tied to both the increase in the replacement limits and the equipment allowance are pretty old numbers in there, and with the changes in the equipment costs and technology, we felt it was important to change those numbers to reflect the current practices that folks have as they go before this committee. The Section 4 is what Senator Berglund referenced in terms of mandates and life safety codes. One of the things, and for those of you who were here last year, we had a bill that resembled a little bit of this section relating to life safety code changes, because 2 years ago there were some changes in the life safety code, and we had facilities that were required to build a separate room for oxygen tanks and to move certain storage materials from the generator room, a lot of code changes. Since that time, CMS has also published regulations to require sprinklers, and we do still have some nursing facilities that aren't fully sprinkled in this state, and we think that's an important thing to have a mechanism that will allow facilities to either upgrade their sprinkler systems or to add sprinkler systems in the first place. And since that is a federal mandate that has been already published as a regulation, it would be covered under Section 4. And then Section 5 does have funding for the moratorium exception process, and we asked for more money than we usually get, but we did want the committee to realize what the cost benefit is for this. For every $1 million that you appropriate for the moratorium exception process, you actually have $76 million, between $75 and $80 million worth of projects, because it's only you're only funding the state Medicaid portion of the projects, and it's over the period of time of the life of the construction. So it's a good, we call good bang for your buck. An investment of $1 million equates to about $70 to $80 million in construction, which is huge for local economies. And with that, I'd answer any questions.
Ms. Cohen, when you mentioned nursing homes without sprinklers, I assume that had been taken care of by now. How many facilities do you think there might be without anything yet?
It's less than 25% have nothing. However, the new life safety code criteria, Mr. Chair, require things such as sprinklers in closets, sprinklers in overhangs, sprinklers in walk-in freezers. So the old sprinkler systems don't meet that criteria.
But there's still as many.
There's still about somewhere around 20% that aren't sprinkled.
Questions from the committee? If not, Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, and I will be brief. I would just like to stress that the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance joins care providers in supporting this legislation. We believe that in preparing for the age wave, you must not only take care of the operating costs, but also the property needs of facilities throughout the state. We know that over 54% of facilities will need either significant replacement or renovation in the next 10 years, and this is a start to meeting those needs. So I thank you for your consideration of this proposal.
Thank you. Is there questions from the committee? Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Berglund, and testifiers today. I'm a big supporter of the bill and putting more money into nursing homes, both for their operating rates and facilities. But I have to ask the question, since you brought it up. Somebody's going to ask, sprinklers in a walk-in freezer.
Okay. Now, is that federally linked, or where did that come from? Okay, I'm seeing heads bobbing. Okay, so that's a federal mandate. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that's on my wish list for the one-time money the state has available would be for these life safety things that are mandated by the federal government. So any of you that have any interest in this, I just call it to your attention so that we understand that the bonding committee isn't the only committee that has needs for one-time money.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, as long as we're totally off topic, Senator Berglund, I couldn't agree with you more. I wish we had had separate and better conversations about what to do with the money that's basically left on the bottom line of this biennium. I think it's a discussion that's been noticeably missing. There are several things, like you mentioned, and some things for schools. There are some great things that we could have done cooperatively here if we'd have had those conversations, I think.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, the money hasn't actually all been spent yet, so I encourage you to approach the leadership of both caucuses to see what can be done.
Thank you.
Further discussion on the bill? Senator Bergen.
If not, then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 261 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Division of, to the Committee on Finance.
Is there any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And with that, before the committee adjourns, if any members weren't here earlier, we may be needing some extra meetings. If you have strong preferences, whether it's evenings or Fridays, let us know. Let my office know in the next day or two. Thank you. With that, the meeting's adjourned.